Well, settle down, everyone. We're going to move directly now into our first panel, which is a very key part of this program. As I alluded to earlier, now that we're 3 years deep into the Obama administration, it's not just a matter of aspirations and goals and policies. It's a matter of implementation and measurement of progress, and there have been quite a few reports this past year in particular regarding that, not the least of which is, or foremost amongst which, is the Obama administration's report of September 16th of this past year, which is called the Status Report, speaking of successes and maybe other things that still need more work. And that's the primary objective of this first panel, as well as mentioning other reports and critiques of that first report as well. And we've got a terrific panel set up for that, people who have been very active in this area. And they're moderated by their leader, Patrice McDermott, who was referred to earlier. Patrice, I'm sure just about every one of you knows, is the executive director of Openness, OpenTheGovernment.org, which has become, I think, the principal coalition or umbrella organization in the openness and government community. And she's also a member of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy Advisory Board. And I will not say anything more about her background because you have full bio in part of your handouts, but I will just leave you in her very capable hands.
Thank you, Dan.
So the people on that side can actually see. This is a real problem, actually, Dan.
Oh.
The podium. People on right there probably can't see.
You know what we can do? All we have to do.
Is that roll?
Yes.
Okay, roll.
Think of this as like a backlog right here.
That's fine.
How does that look?
Can you see the panel now? Okay, great. Well, then I'll sit down.
Well, it's important that they be able to see you as well as Amy. Let's go back.
No, or I can stand.
A little bit further. It's whatever your pleasure is, Patrice.
Great. So, thank you all for. At the end of this first administration, first term of the administration, or the end of the administration, and is it come on? Is that better?
Turn it on.
Oh, okay.
That button, there we go. Okay. So we are beginning the final year of either the first term or of the Obama administration. And there's a lot to report on, as Dan has said. We have been asked to sort of look at what has happened, particularly in the last year or so, and what we think still needs to be done for the remainder of this term. So we have a really great panel. I have instructed them to talk for 10 to 12 minutes. And so that we have plenty of time for conversation among ourselves, but also, and more importantly, plenty of time for questions and conversation with all of you, because this really is an important topic, and there are a lot of different opinions about what has been achieved, what remains to be achieved, whether promises have been kept, whether, as some news reports would have it, we were lied to. I think Frank Greeter gave us a great opening view of the real hurdles that face any administration in implementing their best hopes, or sometimes some people's worst nightmares. So I think we can keep that in mind, that there are real hurdles as we talk about what we see as the achievements or, the good, the not so good, and the really awful, or, oh, my God, did they really do that? So with that, I'm going to turn this over to my colleagues. I have asked folks to go in the order of Amy Bennett, who is my colleague at OpenTheGovernment.org. She and I are the two-person staff of OpenTheGovernment.org. Then we're going to hear from Josh Gerstein at, did I say that right? Okay, at Politico. John Wunderlich at the Sunlight Foundation, and Nate Jones from the National Security Archive. We're going to start with a sort of big overview, and then we're going to kind of end up with specific problems, but also an overview of some of the same sorts of angles that Frank addressed, what the hurdles are, the barriers that have been faced, and that sort of thing. So without further ado, I give you Amy Bennett.
Thank you. So my organization is frequently asked to assess the Obama administration, and if you've seen any of our numerous reports, we freely give that opinion. But I think that a lot of how we assess the administration is based on the context that we're talking about. So if we're judging this administration against past administrations, especially recent past administrations, we're doing great. Openness is on the rise. If we're talking about an international context, well, you know, when the United States passed the Freedom of Information Act back in 1966, we really kind of vaulted to the forefront of openness. And since then, we've actually had other countries kind of surpass us. So, you know, we're still top 10%, but we're losing a little bit of ground internationally. If we're talking, though, about our expectations for a president who on his first day in office said that he was going to deliver an unprecedented level of transparency in government, you know, then we're a little bit disappointed. That's kind of the context that I'm going to make my remarks off of today. So I'm going to go through a little bit of what is the really good of the Obama administration, a little bit of the not so good or the missed opportunities, and then a little bit of what's frankly the ugly of the Obama administration. So on the good side of the agenda, the president's out there on this issue. Who would have ever thought that on the first day, you know, as Frank Reeder said, who would have thought that on the first day in office, a president would ever make a commitment to open government? That's a real game changer for our community. On top of that, this is also the president not only personally cares about it; he has told agencies that they need to make openness a core part of what they do. So we put out the Open Government Directive, which tells agencies that they have to draw up plans to kind of bake in transparency, participation, and collaboration into the basic way that they operate. And those plans have to be updated every 2 years. On top of that, the president is even talking about the importance of open government on an international level. So he, last year, they launched the Open Government Partnership, which really requires all countries that are part of the partnership, including the United States, to develop a plan that really kind of ups their openness game within the next year. So the National Action Plan that the U.S. put out as a part of this is really quite, it's a lot more than I think any of us would have expected 2 years into this administration. You know, they have done a lot on openness. They've done a lot that other administrations never would have. So to see them, you know, kind of put out this really big, broad plan was really impressive. So now to move to the not so good. The first thing I want to bring up is the Freedom of Information Act. The president's policy on his first day in office is a game changer. It is a clear departure from the past administration. The Bush administration told agencies, if you can use an exemption to withhold something, if you think you can, use it, and we'll protect you in court. The Obama administration, on the other hand, said, when in doubt, let it out. So, you know, that's a really important policy change. As Frank mentioned, though, not everybody reads those memos so well. So agencies are starting to give guidance to their FOIA reviewers. According to the Department of Justice, all the 15 largest agencies who do 80% of FOIA requests now have updated guidance. The National Security Archive, who actually asked for proof that they'd made these changes in guidance, found a little bit different results and didn't get some responses at all. But even once the guidance changes, that still is just kind of playing around the edges of a FOIA system that doesn't work for FOIA requesters. We have and this is where we have a lot that we could really learn from other nations. So other nations have a clear, transparent way where it's easy for citizens to ask for information. We have kind of a black box where you send in your request, and then maybe you get a tracking number, which you're supposed to get under the new law, but that tracking number doesn't really tell you anything about what's happening to your request or even when you might actually expect to get something back. And then on the other thing that is happening internationally are they have empowered ombudsman who can really act as a fair negotiator between requesters and government when there's a real disagreement about whether or not something should be withheld. We do have the Office of Government Information Services, led by Miriam, and they do an amazing job with a 7-person staff dealing with the entire federal government and with requesters from across the nation who have disagreements. But there are a couple problems with our system. A, as I mentioned, they're a 7-person staff. B, they're not empowered to actually compel agencies to turn over any information. And C, the second part of their job, they have a dual purpose, both to be the ombudsman and to make recommendations for improving FOIA processing. So for over a year and a half, the Office of Management and Budget has been holding on to the first round of recommendations from OGIS. So that's a real missed opportunity. And then, so those are some real game changers that we wish that this administration could really embrace. The second missed opportunity also relates to FOIA, and it's with the Supreme Court decision in Milner versus the Department of Navy. So the Supreme Court really kind of struck a blow for openness when they struck down the government's expansive use of Exemption 2, which was known as a high 2. And the government was using this to pretty much withhold all internal information, so pretty much anything anybody used as a part of their job. And then, so the Supreme Court said, no, Exemption 2 very clearly only relates to personnel rules and practices, so, you know, your employee information. Now, agencies claim that there is some information that they withheld under that high 2 that is now like sensitive maps and passwords for computers that is at real danger of being disclosed. So they are all running to their authorizing committees up on the Hill, and they're asking for new authorities to withhold information. Now, the problem with this is that the committees generally don't ask many questions. They say, okay, agency, you need this new authority to protect information. You know, I support your mission. And they slip it into some sort of a large authorizing bill or a spending bill. Those spending bills and the authorizing bills never actually go through the committees that actually know anything about the Freedom of Information Act. And they're such small provisions that people on the outside sometimes don't even know that they're in there until they're signed into law. And generally, they're a lot broader than they have to be, because if agencies don't have to justify getting a smaller exemption, you know, then they're going to take that opportunity because they want to protect their information. Now, as far as we know, the administration has not told agencies to stop doing that, and they haven't, as we've suggested, brought the agencies together, figured out with them what of that information really deserves to be protected. And then sent a package of FOIA reforms up to the Hill that goes through the committees of jurisdiction that have expertise in FOIA. And gone from there. So, and then I'll jump ahead a little bit. So another area would be on the fundamental classification guidance review, where this is a part of the executive order on classification. It tells agencies to go through and get rid of a lot of their old guidances that just aren't relevant for the modern world. So we know that if agencies do this seriously, like the Department of Defense is doing, they've actually, according to their interim report, eliminated 10% of their old guidance. So that's a lot of stuff that's no longer being classified and just being clogging up our secret system. But we also know that a lot of the intelligence agencies aren't really paying attention, and they're not doing very thorough reviews. When the administration decided to turn back to classification in the National Action Plan, they decided to make a commitment to stand up the National Declassification Center, which is at NARA. It brings together reviewers from several agencies, so it makes it easier and faster to declassify stuff that was classified previously. That's great. We support it. Only problem is it's been set up for over a year, so it's kind of like taking credit for something that you've already done. And then I'll go ahead and jump ahead to kind of the bad side of the ugly side of the Obama administration. And it's really been, we're quite disappointed on the national security and civil liberties side of things, where we've seen the president give in to claims of national security concerns to really turn us back on open government values. So one example of this would be on state secrets, where the policy that he put out, a lot of us in this room full-throatedly applauded. We thought it was a good first step towards finally getting the balance between the need to protect information and the need to give people their day in court right. The problem is that that hasn't actually changed how the government is using the state secrets privilege to cut off people's access to courts. And then I would also mention the crackdown on so-called leakers. Now, we understand that this is something of a zero-tolerance policy, but it's been carried out in such a way where it's not really a zero-tolerance policy. It's kind of arbitrary. What matters more isn't whether or not the information that you're disclosing hurts your agency or national security. It's more about what agency you're sitting at. And these prosecutions have been done in such an aggressive way that it can't help but send a chill down the spine of anybody who's actually looking to blow the whistle on waste, fraud, and abuse. So I'm sure these guys will fill in a lot more, but that's kind of the overview.
Thanks, Amy, and we'll give you an opportunity at the end if there's some time to go back to the points that you weren't able to cover. Josh.
Hi. So I'm Josh Gerstein. I'm a White House reporter for Politico. I also cover the Justice Department and transparency issues and open government issues more generally. And being a reporter, I also face this in terms of actually trying to use some of these tools to do reporting. Amy was mentioning the famous invocation of the president on the first day of office of his pledge on openness, and I have to tell you that it's become something of either a epithet or a swear word or a curse word within our newsroom. I would say in the little area where I sit with the other White House reporters, you'd probably hear it muttered on about a daily basis after one or another frustrating exchange with the White House press office or some other part of the administration. It doesn't seem to us, as a perspective of people that are asking the administration for information on various subjects on a daily basis, some of them that the administration might not want to talk about, that's their overall approach to dealing with us. I mean, I don't feel like I'm in a great position to make, I haven't done the reports you guys have put together, so I don't think I can really opine government-wide on how the whole adventure is going, but I can just say from my perspective and our perspective as journalists, that while I would say there's been some improvement, I wouldn't say that's the watchword of the folks in the administration that we deal with. Overall, I would say based on our perspective and my perspective using FOIA and other tools, just asking agencies for information, that there's been sort of spasmodic compliance with those memos that were issued in the early days and months of the administration. There are definitely some people in the administration that take those memos to heart and are trying to follow them. My general sense, again, in terms of the people that we deal with, is that they tend to be in the minority and that the result of the collision between people that are doing things the traditional way and the people that have taken those memos to heart is this sort of spasmodic disclosure where most of the time you don't get something, but then suddenly something will pop out, or you may not get anything when you request something. You may have to appeal it. The appeals officer, amazing as it might be, might say, yeah, you really are entitled to this, and as has happened with me, it'll go back and forth two or three times before you actually suddenly get something. So it's something to be grateful for, I guess, that in the end you get something. Again, though, from a journalist perspective, we're not writing books and we're not preparing a PhD dissertation. We're trying to write news articles. So a delay of, a month to 6 months to a year to 5 years to get information, you're actually talking about whether the disclosure is useful to us at all. Something that we can get within a week or a month. I've gotten stuff occasionally within a day or an hour. That's very useful to us. When you start getting out at the outside of that window, we're not talking about news anymore in the definition of that term. The other areas where I see continuing problems with FOIA in addition to the delays and backlogs. I still have a longstanding concern about the privacy exemption and the overapplication of it, in my view, in a bunch of areas. The one area that's been of most interest to me recently is the way it's applied in the context of allegations of misconduct by government employees. I think the court rulings on this are pretty clear that most of the time that type of information should be available when you're talking about, particularly when you're talking about a serious allegation and where there's some substantial evidence to indicate that the employee might actually have done what was alleged, say a finding by one component in the agency that the employee did commit this misconduct. The tradition I've encountered at the agencies is basically not to release any information about those types of inquiries except in really extraordinary cases, and that doesn't seem to me that to be the balance that the law requires or a series of cases going back to the 1970s call for, but that seems to be the default approach of most agencies. The other area where I continue to see a lack of implementation is the reading rooms was mentioned, I think, by Mr. Reeder just a few minutes ago. Maybe agencies are posting large volumes of material into these reading rooms, but I've never been able to find anything that I was looking for. You know, maybe there have been one or two cases, but even where relatively recent disclosures in matters that were in litigation and therefore were obviously of significant interest to someone, you know, I've been told, well, you need to make another request for that information and go through the process, again, for disclosed information. And again, from a point of view of a reporter, it's not very helpful. A couple different sort of topic areas where I've been noticing some issues, and there have been some improvements and some continued problems. One area I cover from time to time has to do with military justice, which involves both the military commissions that are down at Guantanamo handling those prisoners down there that the administration has chosen to prosecute that way, as well as the military's justice system, the courts martial, and so forth. The reason that this becomes an openness issue and, in fact, a FOIA issue is, as someone who covers a lot of federal courts, there's one system for dealing with the papers of federal courts and the filings of federal courts that have become, I would say, extraordinarily transparent, maybe a little expensive for some people, but it is very transparent to get information in a very timely and rapid way. That is not the practice of the military justice system, either at the military commissions or in courts martial. The military commissions, I think the Obama administration has attempted to make transparency a priority, but they're trying to sort of graft it onto the military justice system that doesn't make that a priority. If you go and look at the military commission's website, which, you know, I praise the administration for putting up, which is at mc.mil, you'll see their official mantra, I think, is fairness, justice, and transparency, or some combination of the two, of the three. I don't remember the order exactly. So transparency is right up there. And they have, again, under this administration, began putting up fairly comprehensive lists of the filings back and forth between the defense lawyers and the prosecutors and the judges' rulings in these military commissions, which, again, is important because most of us don't have the time or the inclination to go to Guantanamo to watch one of these hearings. So that's the good news. The bad news is, military and the various agencies that are involved here, which include the CIA and probably some other intelligence agencies, continue to be very reluctant to see those documents put out in a timely fashion. So when they are filed, I think there's some standard that they're supposed to come out within 15 or 20 days. They haven't always been doing that. A lot of the information to me is very clearly not classified. It doesn't implicate any classification issues. For example, a discussion between the lawyers and the judge about the scheduling for the case, very unlikely to get into the kind of granular national security issues that would threaten anybody. Even that goes into some abyss somewhere where it's being reviewed. The net result of all this is when reporters and NGO observers and others come to watch these hearings, you're again in this Kafkaesque situation where you're watching a hearing about pleadings and arguments and requests that you've never seen, and that it's just a very difficult way to do reporting. And again, you see this discrepancy between the civilian justice system, the federal courts, and the military commissions quite clearly. There was just a hearing the other day about the practice of shackling the defendant during meetings with his lawyers. If you look at the military commission's website, what was posted about this, that specific thing was blacked out, so you really couldn't tell. You knew there was a dispute about something related to meetings with lawyers and security procedures, but the issue that the guy's ankle is shackled to the floor the whole time was blacked out. They said this has been approved by various other judges and as mentioned in these Guantanamo proceedings in district court. So I went to the Guantanamo proceedings in district court and pulled up the specific filing that they told me to go look at that talks about when you can and can't shackle the guy's ankle to the ground. So it was quite clear that that's what they're talking about, but they redacted all that information. So you see a collision between the way FOIA, as interpreted, treats some of these issues and the way the civilian courts treat them. So there, again, there's still some problems with transparency, and also some of that came out at the Bradley Manning hearings that took place a few weeks ago in Maryland. Similar kind of situation. We could not, in that case, he was being treated with respect to transparency worse than the non-U.S. citizen prisoners at Guantanamo Bay because we could not see the filings from either side that were being discussed in this open courtroom. You're told to FOIA them. If you FOIA them, it'll be denied because there's an ongoing investigation. So it's sort of a catch-22. The other substantive area I wanted to mention is a law that probably some in this room are familiar with, but a lot of people aren't, the Federal Advisory Committee Act. I would think that an administration that was intent on being the most transparent in history would take pride in trying to abide by the terms of that law, maybe even enhance it and see that it's vigorously enforced. Certainly they'd want to see it enforced to the degree it's enforced on many school committees and other city and town boards around the country who seem to deal with this without a great deal of consternation or trouble. In fact, that has not been my experience with the administration. They now have a practice of declaring that meetings that are taking place in person where there are, say, 20 or 25 panel members sitting around at a session, that they can open that meeting by putting a webcam in the corner and leaving it on, even if you can't really see who's talking or you can't even see who's in attendance at the meeting. And they'll tell you you don't have the right to go there in person, maybe because of a security concern or whatever. They announce the meetings late. And then the most substantive problem with that is this issue related to the subcommittee exemption. It's something that has been noted as a problem by openness advocates for quite a while, I think probably a decade or more. That a lot of these committees are sort of figureheads when they meet at the level of the full panel of 20 or 25 people. As many of you know, nothing much gets done at that level. I'm talking here about the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. There are some other ones on technology and other issues. Most of the work there is either being done by staff or by small subgroups of three or four members. The House has actually passed legislation that would require those subcommittee sessions to be open. They passed it last Congress. It passed out of committee earlier in this Congress. The administration has never taken a clear position on it, but a body that's related to the administration called ACUS actually basically came out against it a few weeks ago, which is something that hasn't gotten a great deal of attention. The net result of all that is that you have these committees that are supposed to bring in advice from a diverse group of people essentially deliberating in secret and simply ratifying a decision that was made by staff hours before the meeting at some public session. All in favor, aye, opposed, no, the ayes have it, and the motion's adopted, and that's kind of the end of it. Again, it doesn't seem to me like the way an administration that really is trying to be transparent would run things. It's just odd to me that the closer you get to the White House, it seems to me the less compliance there seems to be with the spirit of that law. So those are a couple areas that are troubling to me, and at least one area where I've seen some progress, and look forward to talking with anybody that has questions afterwards.
Great. Thanks, Josh. John, over to you.
Thank you. So I'm John Wunderlich. I'm the Policy Director at the Sunlight Foundation. First, I want to say it's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to go after Josh. I think that it's great to have the national security topic come up so prominently, because I think it's a little bit too often that the administration gets a pass on national security issues and is able to claim that transparency is the word that they use when they want to say, look at all we've accomplished. And transparency is the good things that we're able to do because we have a vision that other administrations have not shared, when it's actually a much broader term and needs to include things that are uncomfortable or perhaps a little bit more difficult to judge if you're not an expert in national security issues. So I think it's great that we're including that topic. So my organization, the Sunlight Foundation, is an organization dedicated to open and accountable government. And for us, that especially means through the use of new technology. We build websites and databases and tools to bring people closer to information from the federal government. So the main topic that I'm going to address is about the administration and data openness and some of the data that was released as a result of the Open Government Directive. And then I have a couple other topics I want to briefly address as well. But to start off by running through the data question, a quick refresher, the Open Government Directive. So on day one, Obama had a memo saying they're going to be open and they're going to put together new policies. The Open Government Directive came out in December of 2009, and that was the main policy statement, probably the signature transparency policy from the administration, or from the White House at least. That policy required agencies to put together open government plans, which came out in April of 2010. And those plans were required to have each agency write down a plan and a list of the data that they were going to release with specific release dates. So most agencies didn't really do that. Most agencies in their 2010 plan said, we will put together a plan for how to release data. So there was we're like five plans deep at this point in where we're going. But the way that I would collapse this is to say that the agencies were supposed to list data and specific release dates for when their information would come out, and most of them didn't. Some of them did. In the year or so, a little over a year since then, we've done some reviewing of the kind of job agencies have done releasing their data. And OpenTheGovernment.org has done their own review. We looked specifically at Sunlight looked at some of the data that agencies have released. And there were some real shortfalls. Certainly some agencies did a fantastic job and released a lot of information that wouldn't have been released without the directive. The one example I'd like to bring up in particular was the Department of Justice. So remember, in 2010, agencies were supposed to have listed all the their data and the data that they would be releasing and sort of audit their data policies. The Department of Justice, in order to fulfill that requirement, said in their plan, here are 10 data sets, and these data sets are things that we might release at some point in the future if we decide to, and please note that we might just give them to other academics on pain of secrecy because we're not sure that we'll be able to release them. In the time since then, they've released none of the data sets that they had identified for publication. So the path here is the president runs on openness, comes in the first day, we're going to be very open. Let's have a big procedure. We all know how that process went. The White House comes, the OMB comes out with a government-wide directive. Months go by, the agencies come out with their particular plan, and at each level, another piece of rigor is worn off the process until, in the end, we are left with zero new information, even though this is a pledge about openness and transparency. Now, that's probably the worst example, unless you count the Department of Defense with one-third of the federal budget that has almost no plan at all, which, of course, we should count. But ignoring the Department of Defense, Justice is probably the worst example. But that gives you an idea of the kinds of things that we're fighting against here. So when we talk about compliance, I don't think the choice is about hitting yourself in the face with an axe or whatever was described in the last talk. When the White House or OMB comes out with policy, it's complied with if they care about it. OMB has authority to do things. They use it if they care enough to use that authority. The question is whether it's worth someone's time to go about enforcing the things that they've written. This is true over and over again. We've been told so many times that the Paperwork Reduction Act, the bill, the law that created OIRA, that Cass Sunstein is the head of, that it had all these barriers to transparency, and it was very serious, and we need to follow that law. And so we had this process where they redid and rewrote some of the regulations for how the Paperwork Reduction Act worked so that agencies could use social media in their work and a number of other things. Some other provisions of the Paperwork Reduction Act, though, are ignored entirely, right? The ones that say that agencies have to register all their information and go through how they the lawful ways of releasing information and when it's appropriate to impose terms and conditions on the reuse of information. Those requirements are also mandates on CAS as the head of OIRA, but they're just completely ignored. So what we're talking about here isn't just the creation of good policy, but it's also the willingness to do compliance work on it. And it's not, will you defund an agency or will you punish people that are doing a good job? It's which of these problems are worth political capital and is the president forced to care about? We have a hard time as D.C. organizations forcing the White House to care about things. I mean, we work with a lot of great staff at the White House that care deeply about these issues and are often, you know, don't have the authority that they need in order to push things through or don't have the president's ear. So, yeah, it's tough, but ultimately it ends up reflecting on the job the White House is doing and on the president. So in order to move on from this idea of getting more data released in the face of what's often been the failure around compliance with agencies' plans, we've been pushing the idea of agencies auditing and indexing their data. One of the things that's resulted from that push and resulted from a number of other things is the presidential memo on regulatory compliance data. The idea here is that while trying to get an agency to be centrally responsible for all of its data is a complicated, tricky problem, all of its information is a huge body of things, we need to narrow that down. So the president said, let's just ask agencies a very narrow question. Within the refined scope of regulatory compliance data, you should review all of it and make a plan that says here's how we're releasing it well, here's how we're not releasing it well enough, and here's how we're going to improve that. So in January, about 1 year ago, January 2011, agencies were asked in a presidential memo to put together plans. Unfortunately, those plans are not public. Only three of those plans have been released publicly. One of them is fantastic. The Department of Transportation put together a plan that lists all of their major data sets. It was a good faith effort to say, here's all of our regulatory compliance data. Here's information that you can FOIA for, but we won't give you access to, and here's why. Here's information that we've traditionally only released as a result of a FOIA request that we would be willing to continue to do that, and we'll think about affirmatively releasing. Here's data that's been released as a document, but is actually a data set, and we're going to release it more efficiently. That's the kind of review that we're looking for every agency to do, and that we're looking for to happen outside the realm of just regulatory compliance information. Those things are already required by other laws and other procedures and other OMB memos. The problem is just that those policies are ignored. And again, the central philosophy here is that we need centralized responsibility and centralized oversight for information policy decisions. Patrice says this all the time, so I have to cite her as saying this, but the role of a CIO, Chief Information Officer, should be something more like Chief IT Purchasing Officer. They're people that manage technology decisions, not people that manage information policy decisions. Right. And so that the CIO position is basically vacant at almost every agency. So the information policy decisions get punted or shuffled down to the department level, and the departments make information policy decisions based on some warped self-interest rather than often on the public interest. So the idea is a review of information policy decisions about what's released and what isn't and how those things are released. Okay. So that's the main point, is about data openness, is that we're looking for central responsibility, we're looking for good information policy decisions about what data gets released and what doesn't, and that by and large that isn't happening despite some revolutionary, well-meaning, fantastic policies from the White House that are nowhere near far enough as far as they should go. Okay. Two other things I'd like to bring up quickly since we're on the topic of evaluating the administration. They both have to deal with how the administration interacts with Congress. The first one I'm bringing up because it's what I think should be an easy case that so far the White House has gotten wrong. It's Executive Order 13457 that was issued under Bush in 2008. This executive order says that it basically says that members of Congress shouldn't be able to meddle in spending decisions. And if they want to make an earmark, it needs to be passed as a law. And members of Congress shouldn't be able to strong-arm agencies into spending money on their pet projects. And if they do, it has to be through Congress acting as Congress, not through free agents that are trying to strong-arm the agencies. So this executive order says that executive branch officials must make spending decisions based on transparent statutory criteria. And if a member of Congress starts bothering you, you have to ignore anything that's verbal, and the only thing you can pay attention to is something that's written. And if it's written, then it has to be posted online. And this is a standing executive order. It still exists. It's on NARA's website, and it's on the White House. It's 13457. It's ignored. I think there's been three or four documents posted ever as a result of this executive order. And it's not like this is an unimportant issue. Maybe once a month there's a story about Michelle Bachmann or whoever railing against earmarks and then writing one letter after another to agencies saying, you really need to spend money on my district. It's one thing to just ask for it, but it's another if you're the chair or ranking member of an authorizing or appropriating committee, because your request for money to be spent in your district is suddenly backed up with the implied threat that it's going to mess with your ability to get your budget request fulfilled. So this is actually a serious problem and undermines Congress's power to act as Congress when individual members of Congress can strong-arm agencies into spending money on whatever they want. And they are often successful. If you look through, we've got a running page of every report about where this happens, and it is something like monthly that this occurs. We've raised this with the administration a number of times. I know that they're aware of the issue. It was recently reported that the White House was circulating through Congress a draft executive order that would rewrite the standing one and cast it in their own terms, and presumably that they would start enforcing it. Now, the only way that I can interpret that is that they're aware that it's an issue and are just going to continue to refuse to enforce the standing executive order requiring these requests to be published. So, again, easy question. Protect merit in spending decisions within the executive branch from meddlesome members of Congress. No reason not to enforce it. Instead, we've got 4 years or whatever into the administration, and we've got a rewrite of an existing policy that's pending and may not ever be issued. Okay, final issue, and I'll be very quick. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the super committee. If you can still go to change.gov and read where it says that Obama would end the practice of writing legislation behind closed doors. The Budget Control Act that created the super committee was itself a secret bill that was released maybe 10 hours before it was passed. And that bill created the super committee, which was a process that was defended by the president. And by defending that process, he lost the high ground on a number of issues. If Congress passes a secret farm bill with no hearings and no description of what's in it, with only an hour to read the bill, that is a process that the president has now endorsed by endorsing the supercommittee process, because that's what the supercommittee was going to do. If Congress rewrites the way Social Security benefits work or Medicare benefits work or restructures the way that the Department of Defense is funded, with no hearings and with no understanding where the provisions came from, with only a few hours to read the bill. Again, this is an approach that the president has endorsed by endorsing the supercommittee process. So we were very vocal about the step away from accountability that the supercommittee represented. And even though the supercommittee has kind of faded from our minds because it's failed, I think it's worth remembering exactly what kind of process it was that the president doubled down on and claimed as politically courageous when it actually completely removed the most important decisions of the time from any kind of public accountability.
Thanks. My name is Nate Jones. I'm the Freedom of Information Act Coordinator at the National Security Archive. And I always have to quickly say that despite our scary name, we are non-government and we file FOIA requests from the government. So now that I have that out the way, my esteemed colleagues have done a really good job kind of talking about the good, the bad, the ugly 3 years into the Obama administration. So what I'd like to do is give some theories about the, I'll call it the Obama performance gap on openness. So despite his excellent proclamations and his results, some are okay, some are not so good, some are good, why is there this big gap? And I'll just throw out about five or so theories, agree, disagree, we can talk about them later, and a lot of them echo some of what Mr. Reeder said. Early on in the administration, we heard all the time, Rahm Emanuel loved to say it, listen, changing government from the Bush administration is like turning around a supertanker. We turn the wheel and it takes a really long time to do. Well, 3 years later, they're not saying that anymore, maybe because it looks like the tanker hasn't really turned. But even more than one boat, what we've found doing a bunch of FOIA requests and FOIA audits is that it's actually 96 boats in a flotilla. And some of the captains are pretty good, and some of the captains aren't listening to the admiral at all. So it's more difficult than just turning one ship around. It's controlling the executive branch, I believe, 96 federal agencies, which is tricky. That's one of the reasons, one big reason. Quickly, another one is the governmental devotion to process. Public rulemaking, notice and comments periods, impact statements, intense congressional scrutiny. These are all things that the openness community loved during the Bush administration and helped squelch some of his worst ideas. So I would be, I have to note the irony that these things also are some of the problems that when we want something bang, bang, we have to go through the same hoops. Not necessarily a bad thing, but maybe an irony. Occasional bumbles by the White House. Every new administration has bandwidth problems and is getting into the job. But one story that probably has gotten more press on openness than anyone else was the headline, "Most Transparent Administration Ever Meets with Transparency Groups in Secret." And I think Patrice was there. And from my understanding with talking to people, that's what happened was during Sunshine Week, there was an organized meeting with Obama on the calendar, an official meeting. Probably was press would be talked to afterwards. And then Libya happened, and the meeting got shuffled for national security reasons. And then a week later, the White House calls him up and had a good, very productive, I think, hour-long meeting saying the right things, and everyone was very happy. But apparently, the White House scheduler forgot to put this meeting on the schedule as an oversight. And the press didn't see it. They kind of got it backwards, and then you get a bad headline that left a bitter taste in the White House's mouth because, look, we try and work hard on transparency, and this is what we get. And kind of left a bitter taste on the in some of the group members that met his mouth as well, which was really just an oversight and didn't need to happen. Another example, the National Declassification Center, a great ally, and I would be remiss if I didn't say this from my position as a historian. In the historical community, this is scratching our heads. Declassifying documents takes a lot of work and a lot of manpower, and they did a great job, still do a great job doing lots of pages, but they have a 400 million page backlog. And I can say it's nothing other than a bumble when their main press rollout and their biggest PR stunt is the release of 7,000 plus pages of the Pentagon Papers, which have been available on every public library's bookshelf for 30 years. So I don't know, there are other things that they could roll out that wouldn't make the historical community that already has these documents and wants other ones not scratch their head. Mr. Reeder called it bureaucratic inertia, and I also would go a step further in saying maybe some agencies haven't really bought into Obama's transparency initiatives. And we've spoken a little bit about what are the pressure points that can make the 96 agencies follow Obama's pronouncements. One is OMB, which we talked about, but especially on the Freedom of Information Act, I think another one is the Office of Information Policy. In the Department of Justice, which statutorily that's the office that's responsible for writing and enforcing and doing all of the government audits on Freedom of Information Act. If you want a kick, go to C-SPAN and watch Melanie Puste's testimony about 2 years ago, and her and Senator Grassley really go at it. That's all I'll say, but it is fun to watch. She's the director of OIP. So at the same time you have Department of Justice, which is responsible for enforcing FOIA, at the same time you have that, you have another part of Department of Justice writing a FOIA regulation for the DOJ, essentially saying that they are allowed to lie to FOIA requesters in some circumstances. So it's just really hard to square when you read the day one memo that says Department of Justice enforce FOIA, and then maybe another hand of the Department of Justice acting completely against this idea of transparency. Another example, assistant to the Solicitor General in another Supreme Court case about FOIA, Justices Scalia and Sotomayor asked him, do you believe that FOIA exemption should be as narrowly construed as possible? It makes sense because if you construe them broadly, it could say everything. And the assistant to the Solicitor General said, we do not endorse that principle. He was setting himself up for Milner. But for someone outside the government, when you see these day one pronouncements and then see the same government, the same Department of Justice, arguing the other way to the Supreme Court, it really makes you scratch your head. One more quick one, just that you guys should know about. You guys should know about the CIA has issued new regulations about mandatory declassification review, which is another way to get information. I'm not going to get into it. But they claimed, without a notice and comment period, which is bizarre, that they now have the right, like that, to charge up to $72 per hour of search, even if no document is found or released. So either the Obama administration isn't communicating or the CIA is not telling them, but something's not working. Two more points, quickly. Maybe inexperience making government stand to attention, and this has been hit on a lot. The good example we've talked about is there was an executive order that said you have to do a fundamental classification review in 1 year. After 1 year, 19 of 41 agencies had done that. More have done it since. But naive Nate thought, if it's an executive order, you have to do it. I learned quickly that's not necessarily the case. And then the other day, over MLK holiday, I read the brilliant quote from Ken Salazar, the director of the Department of Interior, saying, fix the quota on MLK, do it in 30 days, because I know that nothing works in the federal government unless you do a timeline and make it do it. And kind of bashed his own department. And I actually kind of jumped out of my chair in glee, thinking, well, maybe that's simply what Obama has to do about FOIA. Set some deadlines, roll some heads. I'm disheartened by Mr. Reeder's answer that no, it won't work, but I am heartened by his candidness. And my last point, and I actually think this is one of the most important points, and John hit on it, especially since we're at the Collaboration for Government Secrecy, is that if you look at everything Obama says, he bolsters transparency and on some things has done good work. But he has this tendency to have an asterisk that says anything national security or intelligence is outside of the transparency bubble. One piece in Atlantic a while ago said that Obama had a romance with the CIA. Other people say that no, he's just not strong enough to fight these entrenched interests. But whatever the reason, what that means is it actually creates a bigger problem, which is ironic, because it's only natural if that there's a sphere of government that is protected from scrutiny and transparency, it's only natural that every agency that doesn't want scrutiny or transparency will try and get in this sphere. So what you see is, because of Obama's transparent actions for the bulk of government, lots of it is trying to get away. A great example of this is FOIA exemptions. They came out and said, we're going to use Exemption 2, privacy, which means everything, and Exemption 6, another catch-all exemption, less. And they did, and they touted it. But Exemption 7, which is law enforcement, skyrocketed. So one of the bad impacts of this is moving more and more information into the security, making national security sphere greater, and making transparency less. In conclusion, I would have to say that it looks like, despite the great proclamations by Obama, he's been maybe unable, maybe unwilling to really make them take into effect. But the silver lining is, as we talked about, it's a priority to him. A day one proclamation isn't nothing. So I do have hope that he can either find the ability or will if it is truly a priority, like it looked like.
Thank you. I see that some of the panelists for the next panel are here and would tell you that Dan, who has stepped out, gave us an extra few minutes because we started late for our panel. So I'm going to allow one quick round of questions for one another, if you have them, very quick, and then open it up to the audience. And if people want to start lining up at the microphones, that would be good.
Yeah. I have a question for Amy. What do you think about the creating a FOIA job series? Could that be possibly a victory, or?
Well, it could be, but the last draft that we saw of it, the idea behind creating a FOIA job series is to make it a more a leadership position. So right now you don't go into FOIA for your career. So it was to create this job series so that you promote people, a ladder, so that you promote people that do well and who really care about FOIA and who develop expertise. One part of the idea was, you develop people who can assess the numbers, who can really, figure out where management problems are. But instead, the job series that we've seen from OIP is more just a managerial type position, just another bureaucrat, unfortunately.
Well, it also, one of the problems is that it allows for people who want to move into supervision. It clarifies that, but people who want to stay in a FOIA track but not move into supervision, because not everybody wants to be a supervisor, that ladder is not there from the last version we saw. So,
right. And can I add on to that? Since you asked about that, the creating the FOIA track is part of the National Action Plan under FOIA, and then kind of the secondary piece of that was that they're going to use technology to improve processing. The problem with that is that this is a process that's all being run out of the Office of Information Policy, which, in case you didn't realize, some of us here have a little bit of problems with the way OIP does things. The OGIS is working with the EPA and the Department of Commerce on a project that we think has a lot better chance of really kind of being that game changer that I was talking about, where they're creating a FOIA portal, which will allow people to make easy requests online. It'll make it easy for the agency, in theory, to make it easy for the agencies to know where they are, to manage their caseload, and make it easy to then send out the information and to publicize that information. So, we would have preferred that rather than going back to OIP and allowing them to do their OIP thing, as far as we know, that they had really embraced the idea of this FOIA portal.
Okay. So, I think you were up first, and then you.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
It's okay.
Please identify yourself.
My name is David Street from NARA. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. Given the comments on the lack of transparency that everyone on the panel has given, the question I'm going to ask anyone can take, was the president's statement on open government or transparency his first day a bit naive and idealistic, given his relative short time as a senator? And the reason I ask that question is the politics in D.C. is much, much different and on a much, much higher level than the politics city councilman or as a state senator in Chicago. So please address that.
Anybody want to take that
on? I would say, I don't think the statement itself was naive, because the content of the statement was general enough to be valid and important to say. So to set that tone on the first day has a huge impact, and I think we're still responding to that. I think that was important, and it sets a bar for future administrations to have to live up to. I think some of the promises he made were a bit naive, especially when he gets into talking about how Congress should function or putting all the healthcare negotiations on C-SPAN. I think he's even acknowledged that was a bit of an overreach as a promise. Certainly his actions acknowledge that was a bit of an overreach. So the statement itself, I don't think, was naive, but some of his promises were.
Okay, I would agree that I think the point that Frank Reeder made earlier, that it was an idealistic statement. It was an important, profound commitment on the part of the administration. But in some of the same ways as when the administration walked into the White House after the inauguration and found out that they had 1980s computers, they walked into a government that was not geared towards openness, a government that after 8 years of the previous administration was geared much more toward resisting the public and resisting openness, and one that just had a different way of being and doing. So, I mean, we can talk about the ship of state and the flotilla, and it's true. And I think there may have been an underestimation of what it would take to turn that around. I don't know that the politics in Washington are worse than the politics in Chicago, but I don't know. Yeah.
So just one more thing. You know, maybe some of the commitments in there were naive, but we have to give the president credit. He put himself out there on openness, and we would not be as far as we are today if the president hadn't personally invested himself and his administration in doing this. So, yes, we're going to complain about the compliance from agencies on a lot of these things because that's what we do. We're advocates. We want the world to be, you know, beautiful and perfect. And you know, we do have a long way to go, but we wouldn't be nearly as close as we are today if the Obama administration was not as committed to openness as they are right now.
I can't name specific documents saying this is how exactly you can use these, but I can say that as a frequent FOIA requester, I would much rather have a B1 national security exemption than a B7 exemption, because there is many more guidelines about how you can claim national security than law enforcement. And I can't really get in the don't have the stuff in front of me to get in the weeds. I can talk to you after about trying to find stuff, but the short answer is it's a pretty useful tool to not provide any information, the B7 exemptions.
Were you talking about the C, the 552C, the exclusion, the lying to the public?
Oh.
Actually, I imagine it's up on their website, but Crew did a FOIA request. And they have heard back from the Department of Justice, and Justice outlined the cases or the numbers that they reviewed. Surprisingly few, which raises more questions than it answers. I think the reality is that OIP, or the Department of Justice, whoever is supposed to review those within DOJ, have not seen the majority of the uses of those by the agencies, and one of the things that the new reg would have done, the bad side of what it would have done apart, would be to require the agencies to submit them for review to the Department of Justice. So there are some numbers. Crew, like I said, had this up on Scribd, and you might check there. It would be very recent. It's probably up on their website. So the DOJ has provided some information about those. It's pretty limited, though. But it's a step. They're, you know, a step in the right direction. So who was up next?
Will Farajal, formerly the National Security Archive, longtime FOIA requester, currently senior fellow at the Fund for Peace and a consultant. I guess taking with Nate's image of the flotilla, the question I have is maybe best addressed by Nate and Josh, but the rest of you would welcome a response as well. Is I wonder to what degree the centralization of the White House and policymaking has affected openness in FOIA in particular. And I mean that largely in the sense of the decline in the autonomy of the agencies themselves to pursue initiatives. It seems to me that almost every major initiative is announced by the White House now. And I'm speaking more broadly beyond FOIA and openness. But two aspects of have been mentioned today about FOIA, or one of them has been mentioned today about FOIA, with regard to OGIS's recommendations that have been waiting for a year and a half at OMB. But also I know during the Bush administration that even there was a process by which sensitive FOIA releases had to be cleared at the White House. So those are very specific about openness, but I wonder if you could address the kind of decline of the autonomy of those flotilla captains, if you will, Nate, in the centralization of the White House in terms, in a negative sense. We have often on the outside, I think, thought that that would be a good thing in order to centralize accountability, but perhaps that's not allowing for individual initiative at the agencies. Thank you.
I got you. On the one hand, I agree with you. For especially pretty good FOIA agencies, I always like to give credit to the Department of State, and NARA has a huge backlog but works hard. For the good agencies, as a frequent requester, yeah, you want them to have the autonomy. But on the other hand, for the bad agencies, if they have autonomy, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. So from my point of view, the least bad answer is a centralized system that hopefully doesn't step on the good agencies too much while using the stick to force the bad agencies up to snuff.
I think, you know, this centralization does go on. I've seen some documents over time that have showed that especially high-profile requests are circulated into the White House. Not necessarily the substance of the request, but to keep them aware of things that reporters like me or other requesters might be asking for. I mean, I think that in general, I guess it's going to depend, as you sort of alluded to in your question, whether the administration's interested in openness. If it is, I think that on balance, it'd probably be better to have people at OMB cracking the whip on people at agencies to move in that direction, especially with respect to the agencies that are very, very slow or non-compliant. And there's all kinds of regulations that I see coming out of agencies that I think are just not legal. But so you wonder if anybody reviewed them somewhere higher up in the chain of command. So I would think that would be a positive overall, but I understand what you're saying. I do think there are individuals at agencies that, as a result of this centralization, live in constant fear of being called on the carpet by the White House or of raising their head or their agency's profile slightly in the news media in any fashion that would cause it to be, you know, bashed down like the whack-a-mole from a carnival game. So, I think on balance, as I say, with a administration interested in transparency, it's probably, I'd rather see more attention to this issue paid at the White House beyond just sort of pronouncements and in terms of application.
Just very quickly, when you're looking at the tension between centralized White House control and distributed departmental control, you have political self-interest from the White House or programmatic self-interest from the departmental level. And neither one, I mean, both are always going to be a risk of one kind or another. And the force that's supposed to push against both those kinds of self-interest, at least as far as transparency policy is concerned, is congressional oversight, which is usually missing entirely. So if I were looking at how to realign authority over information policy decisions. I think less about whether control is too centralized at the White House or within agencies, and more about the completely missing Congress.
I'm Kimberly Payne. I'm a student here at WCL. I was just wondering what each of you think is the greatest achievement and the biggest disappointment.
I thought establishing a FOIA career track, because then we'd have allies from the inside. Greatest disappointment was how blatantly agencies don't ignore his executive order on classification.
So the achievement, I'd say, raising the profile of the issue, but that's a cop-out. The other big achievement would be the self-applied lobbying disclosure policies that the Obama administration did around TARP, the stimulus, and the Dodd-Frank implementation. And the biggest disappointment, I would say, is the super committee.
I think there are some really impressive efforts going on at affirmative disclosure online, even at the level of the White House through the visitor logs that will be discussed later today. I mean, it's a pretty dramatic breakthrough in access to data that is very useful to people of all sorts at a very high level, and so I think that much of it should be saluted. I would say, in terms of disappointment, it goes back to what Nate was alluding to earlier. When push comes to shove, there's a great deal of reluctance to get into anything in the national security arena that could be problematic in terms of disclosure. And the case study or the poster child of this would be the president's decision under pressure to reverse judgment on releasing the photos of detainee abuse and to decide from his level that that stuff wouldn't come out is a pretty, in my view, dramatic backtracking from the pronouncement that he made on the first day of office.
I would say that, back to the good side of the ledger, the president really should be admired for really putting himself out there for transparency and opening himself up to the kind of criticism that we gave him here today. If he hadn't really taken that big step and put himself out there, we wouldn't have anything to complain about. On the bad side, it really is this administration's rather arbitrary and very aggressive crackdown on so-called leakers.
And I would place on the good side ledger the accomplishments. They're really wonky things. But the executive order on controlled unclassified information that this administration took out of the hands of the national security community and put it in the hands of OMB and turned it into a government-wide information sharing policy instead of a information hiding policy. And also the release of the intelligence budgets, some of the things about our nuclear posture review, some things in that area that this administration has taken unprecedented actions in doing. On the disappointment side, I would have to weigh in general, the rest of the apparent unwillingness to push back at the national security community, the intelligence community, and the caving, what from the outside looks like caving, on some issues relating to disclosures of information and some of the policies in our implementation of the war that have been unnecessarily secret, I think. So, Dan, do we have time for one more question? I know you've got your whole other panel here. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. Well, all right.